Mr. Atkins, Reel 5.
Yes. We got as far as Kenitra and into the foothills, and we were required then, I as the MT sergeant based back in the echelon, to always have the transport ready to take the vehicles up to the front at night time with hot food and water. This was a nightly excursion, and each night we had to run the gauntlet of again the British French artillery defensive fire that it put down on the approach roads to our positions in and around the foothills of 1634. So eventually there was much hardship in the hills suffered by the battalion, and in one instance the great majority of one of the companies was captured in its attempt to capture the final positions on this hill, 1634. This particular company, I think was A Company, I don't know who the company commander was at the time, but I do know that the company sergeant major was the one that I mentioned much earlier, company sergeant major Lem Wells. They were taken prisoner and taken away by the Vichy French, and we heard no more of them for a little while. However, to cut a rather long story short here, we eventually did overcome the British French opposition, and the chaps who were taken prisoner were eventually recovered. I think the British French had sent them away somewhere to, whether it was into France or somewhere in one of their domains. But one of the conditions of the armistice was that all prisoners would be released and returned to their own forces, and that did subsequently happen.
What condition were they in when they were released?
I didn't see them directly at the time when they came back, because by then we'd gone on to a place called Homs in Syria. And I'll sort of develop that a little bit for you in a moment. But they were recovered, and so far as I know, speaking to them after the event and seeing them, they all seemed reasonably happy. They didn't seem to have been, I don't think, badly treated. There were one or two caustic remarks about the Vichy French and some of their coloured troops, I believe. They had some of the coloured lads there in their army. It's all army still, I suppose. But as far as I know, they were all right. They didn't suffer any undue consequences from it. anyway, we eventually got ourselves based in this place called Homs, and in a place called the École Militaire. I interpret that as being a military college in French, is it? Or the French interpretation? Yes. And my goodness me, what a dirty place it was. Oh dear, oh dear. It was a shambles, and it was dirty, and it stunk something awful. But being the Second Queen's Royal Regiment, of course, we set to, and promptly put it in good shape and turned it into a habitable sort of area to stay for a short while. We never knew how long we were going to be there. And there we were not for very long. But at this time, also, a change in my own service routine took place. And I was sent for by the MTO one day whilst we were there. And he said to me that because we were very run down on motor transport, a lot of the MT drivers were not required. They were surplus to requirements as such and would be posted back to duty, as we called it, i.e. infantry normal run-of-the-mill infantry soldiering. So I said, yes, sir, okay. And then he broke the very sort of sudden sad news to me. He said, I think now, Sergeant Atkins, it's time for you to have a change. I think you should go back to duty as well to acquire more experience. At the time, I was deeply disappointed about that, very disappointed, because I was MT at heart. He was a very, very good man. He had very, very high standards. His name was Otterway, Cecil Otterway, and he was the MT sergeant in my early days when I joined the battalion in Parkhurst, Isle of Wight, and he subsequently was promoted to MTO and went on eventually to become Major Cecil Otterway of Headquarter Company. Probably get mentioned again as I go on. But he told me I had to go back to duty. And therefore, then from there on, my fortunes also changed. I was posted to C Company as a platoon sergeant. Now, because I knew very little of the duties of a platoon sergeant as such, it was decided that the battalion run a number of internal courses, and one of them was for the duties of a platoon sergeant, and also to update him on his standard of weapon training, knowledge of weapons, and basic infantry tactics concerning a platoon, either in defence or in the attack or patrol activities, whatever. They were fairly numerous, but that covers it generally. So I attended this course, and that was run by a very young officer, one of those that was called up during the war from their civilian occupations, and didn't really have much time for us regular British soldiers. There was definitely a certain amount of animosity there. I ought to have mentioned this earlier, but it did exist. And I think the basis of it all was, you are the regular soldiers, you were the people who were in the army before this, why the hell didn't you do the job in the first place and we wouldn't have had to been called up? And I suppose they had a little bit of a right in saying that, because we hadn't really acquitted ourselves very well, had we, as the old regular army. But then again, it wasn't large enough to carry out the commitments that it was asked, and neither was it equipped as such. But that's another story. However, this course went on, and I got down to brass tacks and took it all in. And eventually, I qualified with a degree of success in it. Mind you, this is all theory, you see, when you work it out. Well, one's not under pressure when you're doing this type of course, and therefore you're under certain semi-peaceful conditions, and you're able to absorb all that's being told you. And I was able to learn the theory of small arms fire, again, what one should do on patrols, what types of patrols that you might be required to do. They were things like standing patrols, reconnaissance patrols, fighting patrols. They all had their different intricacies on how they should be performed. They were some of the duties that I had to learn, and I learnt them as I was asked to. And then I became platoon sergeant of 14 Platoon C Company in the École Militaire in Homs. And I think at that stage we go to the next stage of events.
Please.
Right? Now, again, because it was a war on, suddenly you get orders very suddenly. And the battalion received orders that they were to move immediately to the docks in Beirut, I think it was, Beirut. And there we were to embark on three cruisers, HMS Neptune, Achilles and Ajax. And we were to proceed down to Alexandria with utmost haste. No reason given, no where we were going or anything. So up we went, we took the transport, what little we had of it, and we drove straight down into Beirut and embarked on those three cruisers. And without much ado, as the Navy is good at, we opted.
Which one did you go on?
We went on the Neptune, HMS Neptune. She was a 6-inch gun cruiser, I believe. If I remember rightly, she might have been 8-inch for all I know. Can't quite remember. And we successfully negotiated that voyage down to Alexandria, where we disembarked, and once again went into that little base, big base camp called Amarea. And then we were told, right, everybody will pack their equipment into their big pack. Nothing else will be taken. Nothing. All your web equipment, your weapons, and everything that you really own will go into that big pack, including 24 hours rations. And they, when I say rations, they were the old army rations of hardtack, tins of this and whatever. Nothing that could deteriorate in any short space of time. And in the early hours of one morning, this would be about, I suppose, September of 1941, that's right, 1941, about September, or in that particular period of time, we were told that we would be moving out that night and that we would wear plimsolls, not boots, and we would be going and embarking on destroyers. Now, we all thought, oh, destroyers, plimsolls, in for a long sea journey here. We all thought we might be going home, you see. But we got onto the destroyers. I'm not sure the name of my particular one, but I think it was HMS Kingston. I'm not too sure. And we sailed from in the hours of late evening, I believe it was. No, wait a minute. Yes, it would be. I suppose about late evening. And we sailed. And after we'd cleared the Alexandria Harbour and were into open sea, it was announced over the tannoy that we were heading for Tobruk. And that's the place I mentioned earlier, that the Australians were still occupying and defending. Now, the reason for us being sent to Tobruk was to relieve the Australians because, and you will have read the papers in recent days, won't you, of the Prime Minister of Australia and his accusations about the British government, etc., etc. And we were being sent in so that the Australian forces could be relieved and sent home. Now, that wasn't done with any grace on our side. As far as Winston Churchill was concerned, he wanted to keep them there because he saw the overall strategy of the war as a whole. But whatever the beings there, the Australian government said, no, we want them out and we want them home. And they stuck to their guns. And so Winston Churchill gave into the idea and said, right, what we must be. And that's the reason we were sent up there into Tobruk to relieve the Australians. Now, we negotiated that voyage very successfully, except for one minor dropping of some bombs well astern of us, but nothing to except that it did create the shades of Crete again, but that was all it was. And then in the hours of darkness on the second day, we approached the Tobruk harbour. Now, Tobruk, under those conditions, was suffering air raids nearly every night of its life from the German Air Force, who was very nearby. And it was our very good fortune to have arrived in Tobruk on one of the very few nights that there was no air raid, which was a blessing as far as we were concerned. The Navy, the Royal Navy, were absolutely slick. They knew that their ships, the life of their ships, depended on getting in and out and as far away under cover of darkness as it could be safe to do so. So there was no hanky-pankying. The destroyer pulled up along some sort of hulk in the harbour, which was then connected to the shores with a gangplank, and we were told, right, pick up your kit, where you go? All done quietly, with great efficiency on the Navy's part. And we eventually found ourselves ashore in Tobruk, where then, within a space of half an hour or so, we were gathered together, mustered, and marched out to the outer fringes of the Tobruk area, in open desert.
Straight into the defensive.
Straight into wasn't the particular defensive spot. We were in that, in the perimeter of Tobruk. Now, it was then decided which battalion the Australians we were going to relieve up on the front line, on the front wire. And having decided that, an advance party had to be detailed to go up and understudy the operations and get a familiarisation process of what was required on that particular part of the perimeter. And I was sent up on the advance party and went to a post called R65, which was on the southeastern corner of the defensive perimeter. And that was under the control of the Australians. And I arrived there, and the platoon sergeant said, right, okay, Pommy. They welcomed us in their usual good-natured way and did everything to make us as comfortable as was possible under those conditions, and started to give us a routine and a familiarisation on what went on. Now, one of the main things about the operations in the Tobruk perimeter at that time was patrol activity as opposed to anything larger. And the responsibility of each post was to send out patrols deep into no man's land towards the Italian and German positions to see if you could get a picture of what their defensive positions were and what they were like. Now, I went out one night with the Australians, and quite honestly, everything that I'd been taught about patrol activity in that course that I mentioned earlier went completely out of the window. But they were the Australian Army, and they did things their way.
How is it different?
Well, the British Army and the British soldiers themselves go into great detail, particularly about patrol activity. The briefings are very, very carefully done, and you are given precise instructions on how, where, how far, what actions, what you're going to do, etc., etc. Now, my experience with this Australian unit was, okay, Pommy, we're going out tonight. You're coming with us. We'll show you around. So I said, yeah, okay. I knew of no briefing. I just heard the platoon sergeant say, Dick, Harry, whatever the name is, you're on your way with me tonight. I want four pairs, you see. And he gathered them together, and we made our way out of the wire through our own minefields. Perhaps I ought to give you a description of how that was done, shall I? Because that's amusing. Please. That's amusing. Please. To get out of the wire, there was a little gap in the wire surrounding the post, and then there was an anti-tank ditch. But leading from the anti-tank, from the wire to the anti-tank ditch was an inner minefield, and to get over the anti-tank ditch there was a bridge, a little wooden bridge, and then when you got over the wooden bridge there was an outer minefield which stretched for a number of yards. To negotiate that, you picked up a piece of telephone wire which had been secured to a stake driven deeply into the ground. The patrol sergeant picked that up, put it under his arm, kept it taut, and just let it pass through his arm, and he followed the course of that wire. And the whole of the patrol behind him in single file made sure they kept in those steps. Until the patrol sergeant, who knew the required number of paces he had to march, and also the fact that at the end the telephone wire disappeared back into the ground. And this gave you the security of knowing that you'd negotiated those two minefields. That's how we got through the minefields. And it continued to do so when we took over in exactly the same fashion. One of the reasons for that was that the minefields had been so laid and there was no records of them. Nobody knew where they were or whatever. And there'd been casualties here, there and everywhere until somebody simply said, this is the way to get through. They reconnoitred the route through and did it simply like that. Very simple, but it was effective. And we maintained that while we were there afterwards. To continue the story with the Australian Patrol, once we got clear of that, the sergeant said, well, Tom and Dick, you go off that way, you two go that way, you two that, and we'll meet up back here in about an hour's time. You see? Now, I think they had compasses, but there was no direct orders of how far they should go or whatever. It looked to me, appeared to me, to be very, very ad hoc. But who am I to criticise the Australians, because they made a wonderful effort of defending Tobruk. Wonderful effort. Nobody can fault them. It was only their sheer doggedness that stopped Rommel and his forces from taking the place anyway. So I mustn't criticise them. It was their way of doing it. They did it very efficiently, so God bless them. It's their right, isn't it? We had a completely different picture of it. We had our briefings, and after the Australians were relieved, I have to say here that all of them were relieved except one battalion, which was the first 13th Battalion of the Australians, who were unable to be taken out because of lack of ships and lack of time. And they stayed and had the dubious honour, if you like, of saying that they served the whole of the siege in Tobruk without a break. And we were to meet them on several occasions during the rest of the siege. Now, from then on, nearly all the time I commanded 14 Platoon C Company as a platoon sergeant, because the young officers were so few and far between and so many demands were being made on them for more specialist requirements that you were very often left without a platoon officer in charge of the platoon. So it dissolved, and here I was going through my first experience as a platoon sergeant at duty with a company. So you had to learn fast. And not only me, but nearly every senior rank in the battalion in those posts were required to go on patrol nearly every night or nearly every other night. Either a standing patrol, more reconnaissance patrols than anything. And so through that we acquired a fair amount of experience on how to do things. And the stay in Tobruk up until the time of the breakout consisted mostly of that type of occupation. There was nothing to do much by day except to endure shell fire from the opposing artillery from time to time, numerous air raids, Stukas. Might be interesting to tell you that you could, from my post, you could look across the flat of the desert. It did rise up a little bit, not much, but it rose up and then disappeared over a crest. But way over was the escarpment and a place called El Adam, where the Germans had one of their main air bases. And you could see the Stukas and that take off and congregate and then make their way over to us in Tobruk. And the interesting air raid that I will relate to you was on one occasion I was required to report to company headquarters. And company headquarters was something like 500 yards in the rear of my platoon post. And I was halfway between the two points when I was aware of an almighty droning going on. I looked up and I just saw swarms of German aircraft, Stukas in particular,